Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome to the ID the Future podcast. Can the basic building blocks of RNA be produced in prebiotic synthesis experiments? On Evolution News, Stephen Meyer recently observed that a May 2009 Nature paper co-authored by John D. Sutherland titled, quote, Synthesis of Activated Pyrimidine Ribonucleotides in Prebiotically Plausible Conditions, which claimed to have produced RNA nucleobases under prebiotic synthesis conditions, has failed to address the most crucial question in the origin of life, namely the origin of information. Organic chemist Dr. Charles Garner of the Baylor Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry has made criticisms similar to those of Dr. Meyer, and we have Dr. Garner with us on the podcast today to discuss this research. So thank you for being with us, Dr. Garner.
Oh, you're welcome.
Well, this research might be viewed in a certain light as being akin to Miller-Urey-style experiments, but relevant instead to the origin of the RNA world instead of the origin of the protein world. In other words, they're trying to create the building blocks of RNA using chemistry, which they think plausibly mimics conditions on the early Earth. Is that basically correct, and would you please summarize this research paper for us before we get into its problems?
Sure, Casey. Yes, despite the fact that the RNA world hypothesis is decades old, I believe about 40 years old, no one had ever seen a formation of a ribonucleotide until now under anything that was plausibly prebiotic. Now, a ribonucleotide has three parts. It's got a nucleobase, it's got a sugar, and it's got a phosphate group. And these pieces can occur under abiotic scenarios separately, but they've never been found joined together. And so the whole RNA hypothesis was on very shaky ground, and in fact, I'd say it still is. But for the first time, someone has shown, John Sutherland has shown that using plausible prebiotic organic compounds that could be around what he calls feedstock molecules, you could conceivably put together a ribonucleotide. And in fact, not just a ribonucleotide, but an activated ribonucleotide, which means it's set up maybe to join to some other RNA units. Because to get a real RNA molecule, you have to have many ribonucleotides in a specific order, you know, of all one chirality, et cetera, many, many problems there. But for the first time ever, someone's at least seen the three pieces put together. And I believe of the four RNA-based ribonucleotides that occur in nature, he's come up with two of them, I think, by this scenario. So it's a significant advance in that regard, that it's the first time this has been observed. Predictably, it's overhyped by the media. I saw one title that says, Chemist Shows How RNA Can Be the Starting Point for Life. And I think I've even seen things that say something like Secret of Life Discovered or something to that effect, which is vastly overrated. But Professor Sutherland did very careful work. It's a four-page paper, very densely packed, and it comes with 35 pages of supplemental RNA material. I think having said all that, it ends up being not very relevant to the whole question of origin of life.
Now, you said to me in private correspondence, Dr. Garner, that while this work helps one imagine how RNA might form, it really does nothing to address the information content of RNA, and that there was a lot of guidance by an intelligent chemist. Could you elaborate on that a little bit for us and explain why does this address or not address the information sequence problem that's so crucial to the origin of life?
Yeah, in terms of the information, when you stick RNA units together, of course, you don't put them together randomly, or if you're going to get any information or functional molecules, they can't be put together randomly. They need to have particular order in which the four bases go together, and et cetera. And, of course, no one's ever addressed the information content by any abiotic scenarios. In other words, even though this work produced two of the RNA ribonucleotide units in a form that could conceivably begin to join together, one to another, there's absolutely nothing about this that would dictate the sequence. In other words, where would the information come from on how to join those together? And that's not even hinted at in this work. It's not even begun to be addressed, the information content of an RNA molecule.
And that's a very interesting point you made, Dr. Garner, that you said that really nobody has ever made any plausible attempt to answer that problem of how does the information arise in the first self-replicating molecule. And so at this point, that's kind of a very important problem with this experiment. But let's look at the experiment more closely and ask the question, how was the experiment itself finely tuned? In other words, where was there intelligent guidance basically smuggled into this research that might make it so that it really is not mimicking plausible natural conditions, but instead is is mimicking what it is, which is basically a chemist's laboratory with intelligent chemists guiding research. So how do you see this research being guided by an intelligent chemist?
Well, in many ways, the reactions are begun using pure materials, which, you know, are generally not available in nature, you know, especially in any prebiotic scenarios. This is not at all what you consider a lagoon of organic soup kind of scenario here. Even if some of the molecules are plausibly present on early Earth, the chemistry is actually being done with pure compounds under carefully controlled conditions. And for the most part, in almost all these reactions, he isolates and purifies products before going on to the next step. And so there's a lot of intelligent design in all that. At the end, he uses UV light at particular frequencies, particular durations, to clean up reaction mixtures. Again, you know, that has to be intelligently chosen. Now, the idea is UV light could come from a solar source, but, you know, there's still a lot of variables there. The frequencies, the duration, you know, things like that have got to be controlled. So this is basically just laboratory chemistry. I mean, this is not organic soup chemistry here.
The paper itself admits, Dr. Garner, that, quote, although the issue of temporally separated supplies of glycoaldehyde and glyceraldehyde remains a problem, a number of situations could have arisen which would result in the conditions of heating and progressive dehydration followed by cooling, rehydration, and ultraviolet radiation, unquote. So, in other words, they're trying to explain really how a very specific sequence of heating and drying and irradiation could produce the right pure supplies of the feedstock molecules, as it calls it. But this really sounds like a very finely tuned sequence that has to be very carefully monitored so that you don't overcook or undercook just the basic precursor molecules that are used in this experiment. And is this basically right? And I mean, doesn't this sound like very intelligently directed chemistry?
Well, yeah. This whole origin of life area of chemical research, in my opinion, has been grasping at straws from the very beginning. From Miller-Urey on, the findings are often so negligible compared to the problem of complexity of a living cell, for example, the chemistry, the biochemistry of that, that they're generally irrelevant. I mean, even if there's not problems, Miller-Urey made, you know, about half of the amino acids, for example, all in racemic form, and that's assuming certain conditions of the early Earth, which seem not to be present or not plausible anymore, and so which means you get no amino acids. But Miller-Urey, of course, is hyped in every biology book as, you know, a major step forward in origin of life explanations. And no one ever takes that back. You know, they decide there was no hydrogen in the early Earth atmosphere, and yet it doesn't get dropped from textbooks. It's still in all the biology textbooks just the same. And it goes on from there. Virtually everything that in origin of life that's been discovered along the way is grasping at straws in one way or another, in my opinion. And this paper as well. Now, this is one of the better papers. This is probably maybe the best origin of life paper that I've seen yet. But everything they discovered here, at best, makes it only slightly more plausible that origin of life scenario could ever come about. My brother has this saying that when he wins the lottery, he's going to do this and this. And then he goes on to say he doesn't buy lottery tickets, but that only slightly decreases his chances of winning. And, of course, he knows what he's talking about. He's a statistician. It's kind of like this. This paper slightly increases the plausibility of origin of life scenarios, but it's kind of like trying to win the lottery. The chances of this sort of thing are so close to zero that it probably doesn't matter. Really, the only people that put a lot of emphasis on this kind of work are people who already believe, true believers, in chemical origin of life, and they figure the conditions have to be out there, and they've been extremely frustrated that it's not come much easier, that at every turn they've encountered major roadblocks in the chemistry, all kinds of problems with chirality, and which, by the way, was a problem in this work as well. They have to start with D-glyceraldehyde, one mirror image of a simple sugar, in order to get the chirality they need later on. And, of course, there's no plausible source of one mirror image of this sugar. And so that's one of many problems.
Dr. Garner, are there any other problems that you see in this research?
Well, basically, the work was very carefully done, but that's the problem. It was very carefully done, and it has to be very carefully done, or it doesn't work. People have a lot of imagination. You go to the local bookstore and look at how many science fiction books are on the shelf, or fantasy books, more than you could read in a lifetime. People have plenty of imagination. The problem is that imagination really grounded in reality? It's easy to imagine chemistry that, you know, might occur or could occur or might be out there. When it comes down to reality, it's just not very convincing. And there's been some evolutionary chemists that have criticized this work as well. I think you're aware of Robert Shapiro has said this is irrelevant to origin life. He used that exact term, the word irrelevant to original life, in his opinion.
So in the final analysis, this is interesting chemistry, but really the big question is it truly relevant to explaining the origin of life under natural earth conditions? And I think, Dr. Garner, you would probably say the answer would be no.
Oh, definitely. I mean, they've done something here that wasn't clear it could be done. You know, you've developed a ribonucleotide for the first time. Now, what's rather telling there is that people have believed in the RNA world with no evidence at all until now. So when one of these things comes along, you say, well, wait, this establishes it? Then what were you believing for the last 30 or 40 years? Was it pure faith? The answer is yes, it was pure faith. But now they have something they can point to. But having done this, it is relatively implausible to get this in a prebiotic scenario. And even if they did get ribonucleotides, there's the chirality issue. There's the information issue as you join these things together. No one's really shown an effective way to join these together except with a good dose of speculation and imagination. There's just any number of problems. And if you know enough about the chemistry, you'll realize the magnitude of the problem they're facing trying to come up with the simplest plausible living cell from this prebiotic chemistry, and this paper included. This addresses the RNA world, which is a very popular hypothesis, but I mean, I think it's rather telling that how little evidence that hypothesis was ever based on and continues to be based on, really.
Well, Dr. Charles Garner, thank you very much for this amusing and enlightening discussion of this recent research that's being touted to the public, as you said in the media, as proof of the origin of life or of the RNA world hypothesis. And as you very eloquently just put it, well, then what were people believing for all these years before this? Because the evidence for the RNA world has always been sketchy at best. Thank you very much for your time and for being on the podcast with us today.
Oh, you're welcome, Kate.
I'm Casey Luskin with the ID of the Future podcast. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2008. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.